Hello, this is Elton Banks from the North Carolina Reading Service, previously known as the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Triangle Business Journal. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, and Angier. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. They believe every life is unique and deserves to be honored, so that every funeral is as unique and special as the person it represents. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Now, if you're a regular listener to the Triangle Business Journal, you know that every week we open the Business Journal and we look at the biz page. And then we follow that up with all the usual pages. But this week, since it's the end of the year, the folks at the Triangle Business Journal take a little time off. And what they do, rather than provide a full-blown Triangle Business Journal, is they provide a bunch of news articles about stuff going on in the Triangle related to business. So today, rather than reading from the biz page and from the cover story and the business voice and so on, I'm simply going to be reading a sequential set of articles of various and sundry things associated with the Triangle business community. And so we're beginning today with an article entitled Raleigh Developer Eyes Apex for 120 Homes. A Triangle home builder has proposed a 120-home residential development in the booming town of Apex. Raleigh-based Envision Homes filed a rezoning request for the Wolf Properties PUD, asking that the town rezone 43 acres at 1405 Wimberley Road to allow for the development. The land is currently zoned low-density residential, and the request would see that change to planned unit residential to allow for the construction of 70 single-family homes and 50 townhomes. Single-family units would be up to two stories, and townhomes could be up to three, according to the plans. A three-acre recreational area would be dedicated to the town, and plans call for the project to be built out in three phases. The site is currently made up of six parcels, each owned by families and individuals, in Apex. Potential timelines and unit prices are unclear, and Envision Homes did not immediately return calls for comment. Envision Homes was founded by area real estate veterans Mick Michael, Jeremy Spivey, and Josh Swindell. The company lists seven residential properties in its online portfolio, including Park Station in Cary and Trinity Brownstones in Raleigh. It's also built homes in Clayton's Adam Point community, and the company has plans to build 25 homes off Highway 54 west of Research Triangle Park. The Wolf Properties PUD would join a growing list of residential and mixed-use projects in that part of Apex as developers continue to show interest in the community. Down the road off U.S. Highway 64, work has already begun on Sweetwater, Apex's, quote, small town on steroids, unquote. The mixed-use project will be the commercial portion of the Sweetwater subdivision off Highway 64, west of downtown Apex. The town center will take up 45 acres and feature 400,000 square feet of space, including hotel, grocery, retail, and 230 apartment units across buildings up to five stories. The project, to be situated at 2775 Core Banks Street, is a joint venture between the Calico Group of New York and Experience One Homes of Cary. The core of the development features five mixed-use buildings, each four to five stories, situated around an event lawn and concert stage. Also along Route 64, a community with 300 townhomes is expected to be ready for move-in early in 2020. In October, the developer announced the debut of 315 townhomes across 55 acres called Towns at Westford at the corner of Highway 64 and Jinx Road west of Apex. Homes will range from 2,300 to almost 2,700 square feet and offer up to 4 bedrooms, 4.5 baths, and 2 car garages. And in our eclectic mix of articles from this week's Triangle Business Journal, next comes an article on transportation, and it's entitled, What Flyers Need to Know About the Budget Terminal Coming to RDU in 2020. 2020 promises to be a pivotal year for Raleigh-Durham International Airport, where officials say they're on track for the creation of a budget terminal. Right now, Terminal 2 houses the bulk of RDU's flights, with Terminal 1 serving just Southwest Airlines. That changes in April, when low-cost carriers Allegiant Air and Spirit Airlines join Southwest in an improved Terminal 1, the budget terminal, complete with new gates and new amenities, such as a Raleigh Brewing Company collaboration, Raleigh Brewing Tavern. An airline spokesperson said Friday that the plan is on track and that the 4 new gates plan to open at Terminal 1, increasing the gate count there to 9, will open on or before April 1st. For the airlines themselves, it's likely to be an easy move, and one that could mean more room to grow their RDU networks in the coming months. An Allegiant Air spokeswoman said in an email that as soon as the airport has completed its renovations, it will be a very simple move for us. RDU has been working to accommodate the individual needs of the airlines, particularly regarding the new gates it's planning to open. Initially, Frontier Airlines has requested gates that could accommodate ground-level boarding, officials said. Accordingly, A1 and A2 were designed with that in mind. However, at the RDU Airport Authority board meeting on December 19th, staff said the airline was no longer interested in ground-level boarding and that they were returning to the original plan for boarding bridges. The airport confirmed Friday that despite the planned moves for its ultra-low-cost carrier peers in April, Frontier is staying in Terminal 2, at least for now. We're moving the 2 carriers over initially to ensure there's enough queuing space at the ticket counters, an RDU spokesman said Friday. We'll eventually move Frontier over as well, once we're confident there's enough ticket space. A Frontier spokesman didn't return a request to comment on the plan. The Terminal 1 gate additions are already a complex project, even without factoring in moves by airlines. Activating the first 4 new gates at RDU comes with a cost of more than $19 million, according to airport officials. There's already a plan in place to increase the gate count again to at least 13 over the next 5 years. That's as airport staff are exploring ways to increase the gate count even further, possibly to 21 gates through multiple phases. As passenger counts keep increasing, gate additions could be critical in the coming years, officials have said. In October, airport officials predicted that gate additions in Terminal 2 won't be able to happen until the new international runway is built, meaning no new capacity at RDU's main terminal until the 2028 time frame. Airport Authority CEO Michael Landguth says that means any additional gate capacity will have to come out of Terminal 1. Traditional carriers, including RDU's biggest airline in terms of passengers, that's Delta, will remain at Terminal 2 after April, as will all of RDU's international flights. So here's a deeper look at all the carriers coming to RDU's Terminal 1 in April. So Allegiant Air, this is a Las Vegas-based airline that offers flights out of RDU to New Orleans, Orlando, Punta Gorda, Florida, and San Juan, Puerto Rico. And, of course, Spirit Airlines, this Florida carrier, which made its RDU debut earlier this year, flies to Baltimore, Washington, Boston, Chicago, Detroit, Fort Lauderdale, Florida, New Orleans, and Orlando. Well, now we turn to an article that goes under the heading of education. I'm going to classify this as delicious, because the article is entitled, NC State's Ice Cream Earns Tasty Royalties from Harris Teeter. NC State University is already seeing royalties to support its animal science and agricultural programs less than a year since inking a deal with Harris Teeter, allowing the grocery chain to sell the university's brand of ice cream. NC State's been producing and distributing dairy products for much of its milky history. It opened its first dairy production facility in 1940, distributing its products to campus and to state facilities such as hospitals and prisons. In January, the university announced a licensing agreement with Matthews-based Harris Teeter, which goes under the stock symbol on the New York Stock Exchange, KR, for the rights to sell the university's Howling Cow ice cream. Under the terms of the deal, the exact specifics of which have not been disclosed by Harris Teeter, the grocer follows the university's proprietary formulas and sells the product under the Howling Cow brand. According to data provided by the university, the deal's already earned the agricultural programs $115,000 in total royalty receipts, representing three quarters ending in September. And with the list of locations grocers selling the product slowly expanding, those royalty figures are expected to increase. The deal was partly the brainchild of Gary Cartwright, director of the university's dairy enterprise system, who was looking for a way to increase revenue for university programs. Under state law, the university is not allowed to sell directly to the general public. However, it received an exemption in 2005 to distribute and sell products from its campus. While searching for ways to increase outside revenue, the university's technology transfer office put out a call to the dairy industry to sell their license, prompting the Harris Teeter deal. Under the terms of the agreement, Harris Teeter follows the university's formulas and flavoring down to the last ingredient. The ice cream is currently sold at more than 150 Harris Teeter locations throughout North and South Carolina. Funding from the royalties supports a host of programs for the university, including state-of-the-art infrastructure used for research and development. In recent years, under Cartwright's leadership, the university has undergone an extensive value-added strategy to increase revenue for the program without increasing its total dairy production. According to university data, its creamery operations reported $2.2 million in revenue in fiscal year 2019. That's a nearly 40% increase since 2014. During the same year, it processed 394,099 gallons of milk. Next, we come to the section entitled Career and Workplace. Remember, I promised you this was going to be a varied series of articles today, and so far I don't think I've let you down. And under Career and Workplace comes the article, Harvard Business Review's The Big Idea, The Day-to-Day Work of Diversity and Inclusion. And the Triangle Business Journal and the Harvard Business Review collaborate on a number of articles, and this is one such article. And it's a conversation with Dr. Thomas Hunt, who is actually Airbnb's head of global diversity and belonging. And I'll just read the article. Most leaders of U.S. companies know that attracting diverse employees is good business. In response, the prevalence of diversity and inclusion professionals has increased, and diversity trainings have become the norm. Yet these efforts, at least in the current forms, aren't boosting the representation of African Americans in organizations and leadership roles. What needs to change to create racially inclusive workplaces, and how can managers be the catalysts? Melissa Thomas Hunt is Airbnb's head of global diversity and belonging, and has been working at the diversity and inclusion space for decades, both at organizations and academia. So she spoke with us about how diversity efforts can do a better job of addressing the needs of black workers. She emphasized that there's no quick fix. Big wins will come from interrogating seemingly mundane practices and processes, and holding managers and leaders accountable for progress toward your organization's aspirations. And what follows is an edited version of the conversation with Dr. Thomas Hunt. So the question, how do you design a diversity and inclusion program for black workers to reach leadership positions and succeed in them? Her answer, creating a work environment in which black employees can thrive requires deliberate, sustained efforts focused primarily in three areas, data and numbers, company culture, and day-to-day people management. We know that numbers matter because who you hire and at what level directly affects the overarching narrative of what's normal and accepted in your organization. For example, if the majority of your leadership roles are occupied by white workers, you are sending the message that this group has the most potential to contribute at high levels. To change this narrative as a first step, companies need to put more effort into increasing their pipeline of black workers. To be clear, it's no easy feat getting black employees into an organization, and this is true globally for members of the black diaspora living in places in which they are the minority. Historical artifacts of power and privilege create all kinds of roadblocks for black people. Even when economics and levels of education are comparable, social capital, or the networks people need to gain access to opportunities may be less available to black professionals than to their white counterparts. So companies need to start putting more systems into place, whether through HR or recruiters, that will help them identify, attract, and hire black talent, including senior talent, into critical leadership roles. But this alone is not enough. Organizations also need to make sure that the black employees that are hiring into lower-level positions are being given opportunities that set them up for success and growth. This means undergoing fundamental shifts in the cultures they create. Black employees need to enter generative work environments, ones that allow all people to grow, develop, and flourish, and ones that signal they are valued. Without these, there will be a revolving door of black talent who arrive excited, energized, and ready to contribute and leave feeling unseen and demoralized. Next question, how can you make this culture change happen? Her answer, though culture change is hard and the path to it seems murky, we do know that managers are the front line. They're the ones with the power to make employees feel safe enough to contribute their knowledge and perspectives. Managers have the ability to build relationships across difference through their access to other teams and leaders. And managers can use their status to provide growth opportunities to black workers through committed sponsorship efforts and by communicating their value, including their expertise, potential, and accomplishments to others. Real culture change will start when managers learn how to do this, and it will require a top-down approach. Companies need to make it clear that a great supervisor is someone who creates an environment in which a diverse array of people can succeed. HR professionals need to be empowered to help managers advance inclusive behaviors and eliminate those that erode inclusion, belonging, and engagement. Resources need to be put toward training managers to understand the ways in which their own identities impact the way they engage with others. When situations arise in which black employees are experiencing microaggressions or outright discrimination, managers should know how to properly address the issues and escalate if necessary. Organizations also need to create cultures of curiosity where people are in a constant state of discovery, learning about themselves and others. Managers can help make this happen by regularly asking their employees what they need. Holding regular check-ins with each employee is a good way for managers to demonstrate genuine interest in their team's well-being and build a foundation of trust. They should use this time to ask people if they feel supported and safe enough to contribute on a regular basis. This time will also help managers troubleshoot any issues that come up and understand their team members and aspirations, as well as how they can help them get where they want to go. Lastly, managers should be expected to provide specific, actionable feedback to all employees and push past any hesitations they have about how that feedback will land, a fear that often stops white managers from giving black employees critical feedback. Like everyone else, black employees need honest feedback in order to grow and to get access to leadership opportunities down the line. Next question. At some companies, talking about race consists of one formal conversation a year. How can leaders encourage more frequent discussions? Her answer. Conversations about race at work are challenging to have or even begin when the people involved don't have a positive relationship. That's why at regular intervals, your employees should be encouraged to spend time with team members who appear to be different from themselves or peers who they do not know well. Remember that people must choose to create space for building relationships before they feel comfortable having hard conversations when racially charged situations do arise. So it's best to start building those relationships now. When opportunities for discussions surrounding race or ethnicity do come up, those participating will be more likely to assume positive intent. For the conversation to be productive, both parties need to agree that missteps will happen and demonstrate a genuine interest in one another's experiences and perspectives. Next question. How can you get leaders and managers on board with all these suggestions? Her answer. Organizations need to take every opportunity to communicate what's expected of their leaders. It's not the organization's job to change attitudes, but it is their job to weave their values into the processes and practices that reinforce company culture, making sure that everyone, from individual contributors to those in leadership roles, is demonstrating behaviors that align with them. Holding people accountable is vital to doing this successfully. If senior leaders espouse a set of values, but fail to keep the people who report to them accountable for their actions or inactions, middle and lower managers will have little incentive to uphold those values and will focus instead on the business goals that are being measured. We are humans, and our attitudes are imperfect. That's why providing incentives such as measuring diversity and inclusion efforts and performance evaluations, linking them to salary increases or other forms of compensation, and giving employees who demonstrate inclusive values public recognition will help companies establish cultures that reinforce what they stand for. If there's a misalignment between your organization's values and the behaviors your employees exhibit, then your accountability structure is likely misaligned and needs to be rethought. And final question. You've been working in inclusion for a long time. What's changed since you started? What remains stubbornly the same, and what makes you the most optimistic about the future? Her answer. Most organizations recognize that they have a problem with inclusion and are committing to making changes that they were 20 years ago. I'm seeing more companies devote resources to forming diversity and inclusion programs and hiring professionals to spearhead those efforts. There are also communities of practitioners and academics working together to identify and test best practices, whereas before, researchers and those responsible for implementing solutions rarely talked to one another, and they certainly didn't work collaboratively on challenges. But many organizations still want quick fixes. They're impatient for better outcomes and sometimes take shortcuts. Today, certain programs still focus on fixing black employees as opposed to fixing organizational biases. Others showcase one-off diversity and inclusion efforts, such as showy, expensive conferences with a diverse array of speakers, yet fail to yield sustainable gains for black employees because they don't actually examine the day-to-day practices that may undermine black employee advancement. Additionally, people remain concerned about how diversity and inclusion efforts will affect their career outcomes and outcomes of others like themselves if those who are historically underrepresented are given new forms of access and more developmental support. And once again, this was an interview by Paige Cohen, one of the associate editors at Harvard Business Review, with Dr. Melissa Thomas Hunt. Now we turn to an article on healthcare, and very much like the Harvard Business Review collaboration that we just read about, this is an article as a collaboration between the Triangle Business Journal and the New York Times, and it's entitled, "In the U.S., an angioplasty costs $32,000. Elsewhere, maybe $6,400. So, why does healthcare cost so much more in the United States than in other countries? As health economists love to say, it's the prices, stupid. As politicians continue to lament the system's expense, and as more Americans struggle to pay the high and often unpredictable bills that can accompany their health problems, it's worth looking at just how weird our prices really are relative to the rest of the world. The International Federation of Health Plans, it's a group representing the CEOs of health insurers worldwide, publishes a guide every few years on the international cost for common medical services. Its newest report on 2017 prices came out this month. Every time, the upshot is vivid and similar. For almost everything on the list, there's a large divergence between the United States and everywhere else. Patients and insurance companies in the United States pay higher prices for medications, imaging tests, basic health visits, and common operations. Those health prices make health care in the U.S. extremely expensive, and they also finance a robust and politically powerful health care industry, which means lowering prices will always be hard. For a typical angioplasty, now that's a procedure that opens a blocked blood vessel to the heart, the average U.S. price is $32,200, compared with $6,400 in the Netherlands, or $7,400 in Switzerland, according to the survey. A typical MRI scan costs $1,420 in the United States, but around $450 in Britain. An injection of Herceptin, that's an important breast cancer treatment, costs $211 in the United States, compared with $44 in South Africa. These examples aren't outliers. There are so few cases where the United States price isn't the highest that they jump out. Cataract surgery costs more in New Zealand. Kalydeco, a new drug for cystic fibrosis, costs more in the United Arab Emirates. But for most of the studied cases, prices for services and drugs in other developed countries are less than half of those in the United States. It's staggering how much the United States is more expensive, said John Hargraves, the director of data strategy at the Healthcare Cost Institute. That's a group that aggregates claims data from several large U.S. insurance companies and provided the U.S. data to the study. The international survey focuses on prices paid by private insurance companies. In many countries, public health programs pay less, meaning the gap in prices for many countries may be even larger if it took account of every patient. The survey doesn't have information from every country, nor detailed prices for every medical procedure. Drug prices do not include rebates people receive after buying a medicine. But the report's overall message is clear. Prices in the United States are higher for nearly everything, by a lot. Researchers at Harvard conducted an exhaustive study last year of things that make health systems in developed countries different from one another. They found that the United States is distinct in a few ways. But the overwhelming finding of those researchers was that it's this huge gap in prices more than any other single factor, not the number of doctor's visits or hospitalizations, not the quality of medical services, not differences in social service spending, that helps explain why the United States is such an expensive place to be sick. Over the past decade, most of the political health policy debate has been about how to ensure broader insurance coverage for the public. Another way the United States is unusual isn't having so many residents without any form of health insurance. But the debate among candidates for the 2020 presidential race has begun to tack slightly toward policies that will address price as well. the single-payer plan Senators Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren have proposed would use a large government insurer to set prices for all medical services. Both campaigns assume substantial savings would result as that government system lowered prices across the board for doctors, hospitals, medical devices, and drugs. Even plans considered more moderate, like those from Pete Buttigieg, the South Bend, Indiana mayor, and Michael Bloomberg, the media executive and former mayor of New York, would impose some controls on healthcare prices by limiting the amount that doctors and hospitals could charge in the situations where they typically charge the most. President Donald Trump, too, has pushed forward with an initiative to lower prices. Through an executive order and regulation, he's seeking to require healthcare providers to publicize the prices they have negotiated with insurance companies. The idea is to promote more competition through transparency, although researchers are divided on whether the measure will work. He has also worked with bipartisan legislators to eliminate surprise billing, which occurs most commonly in medical emergencies at hospitals, though that effort has stalled. Higher prices are not new for the United States, but they have come newly salient as more health insurance comes with high deductibles and other forms of cost sharing that require patients to pay a larger part of the bill or even the full cost of their care. The overall upward creep of prices has also led insurance premiums to rise, taking a bite out of tax revenue, wages, and corporate profits, too. There's also been some recent bipartisan interest in taking on drug prices specifically, although few policies have gotten very far in Congress. Any successful effort to tamp down U.S. prices, of course, will mean reducing someone's paycheck. The uniquely high prices for drugs in the United States helps make pharmaceutical companies profitable. The high prices paid for hospital care keep large research hospitals and small providers, rural providers, afloat. The high prices help doctors pay off extensive education debt, but also help place them among the highest paid professions in our economy. None of those groups particularly want a pay cut. Now we turn to banking and financial services. And the article is entitled, Why 2020 Could Be a Very Busy Year for U.S. Bank Managers. Predictions that a rush of big U.S. bank mergers is just around the corner are perennially popular, but the facts rarely cooperate. While small community banks continue to link up, deals worth more than a few million dollars are hard to get done. That said, the pieces do seem to be falling in place to make 2020 a busy year for deals, as falling profits and the presidential election sharpen minds at the 4,700 or so banks across the country. The stage has been set this year by a series of tie-ups, which began with a really big one. Two southern banks, BB&T and SunTrust, hooked up in February to create a bank called Truist with $460 billion in assets. That's still small compared with the four mega banks. That's J.P. Morgan Chase, Bank of America, and Citigroup. All have at least $2 trillion in assets, while Wells Fargo is there or thereabouts. But the deal puts Truist in the top 10 and proves that the good-sized deals can get done post-crisis, at least under the bank-friendly regulators appointed by Donald Trump. Just as important as the size of the Truist deal was its structure. The nominal buyer, BB&T, paid in shares at almost no premium. This merger of equals allowed the two sets of shareholders to split the cost savings over time, rather than having the target bank's investors extract their pound of flesh at the outset. This is key because shareholders hate it when a bank they own pays a premium for a rival. Two deals in 2018 that included meaty premiums, that's Fifth Third, MB, and Synovus and Florida Community, resulted in the shares of both buyers taking an immediate beating. Paying now for earnings growth tomorrow is just not in vogue. So Truist raises hopes that the biggest regional banks might follow the no-premium trend, creating banks with the heft to challenge the giants. Consumers should hope they do. The dominance of the Big Four is a real threat to competition. The multi-billion-dollar tech budgets of the biggest players mean they're able to improve their mobile banking tools and their underwriting systems in ways smaller banks simply cannot match. The fact that the biggest banks have captured the majority of U.S. deposit growth in recent years is just one piece of evidence. The tide might be turned if the likes of U.S. Bancorp of Minneapolis, that has $488 billion in assets, M&T of Buffalo, that's $126 billion in assets, or Birmingham, Alabama's Regions Bank, that's $126 billion as well, do meaningful deals. Yet, transactions like this are not easy to pull off, said Rajan Cohen of Sullivan & Cromwell, a lawyer who specializes in bank M&A. You need CEOs that get along and trust each other, he said. You have to be able to negotiate the non-financial issues, the most important of which is, who will be the new CEO? Two recent mid-size no-premium deals have held out reasons for hope. The Iberia Bank / First Horizon and Texas Capital / Independent Mergers created banks with $75 billion and $48 billion, respectively, to be headquartered in Memphis and McKinney, Texas. The shares of both the buyers and the sellers got a bump up when the deals were announced. Banks that are considering a deal could be feeling some time pressure, too. The prospect that a Democrat could take control of the White House in January 2021 and might take a dim view of bank deals has many analysts talking about a window of opportunity that will close in the spring of next year, given such deals can take 7 months or more to close. Mr. Cohen points out that even if Mr. Trump wins again, there might be personnel changes at the Federal Reserve or the other regulatory agencies which could make deals harder. Marty Mosby, bank analyst at Vining Sparks, thinks that the politics may be less important than the fact that low interest rates continue to squeeze bank margins and the benefits of cost-cutting programs are beginning to fade. The result is that in 2020, earnings could be flat to down. It will feel kind of late cycle, he added, adding that this gets people thinking strategically. Brian Klock of KBW agrees. The Boston-based analyst is looking for earnings per share growth of about 2% for the industry next year and notes that most of that's driven by share repurchases and the cost benefit of the deals that have already been done. Without those, we'd have no EPS growth at all, he said. Are slowing profits, a tight political calendar, and the recent success of no premium deals enough to spur major mergers? It comes down, in the end, to Mr. Cohen's point about chief executives. The old saying in the industry is that banks are sold, not bought. Bosses have it pretty good. An interesting job, a big paycheck, and prestige. Doing a low-premium deal requires somebody to give all that up. In sum, the economics are lined up for a big 2020 for bank mergers. The psychology remains to be seen. Now, here's another article in the healthcare arena, and it's entitled How Another FDA Approval Strengthens a Company's Triangle Operations. Continuing its stretch of receiving FDA approvals, a global dermatology company's foothold in the triangle looks even stronger heading into 2020. New Jersey-based OrthoDermatologics, one of the largest prescription dermatology healthcare businesses in the world, has received FDA approval for its newest topical treatment of acne vulgaris in patients 9 years of age and older. Dubbed Arizlo, the treatment is the first tazarotene acne treatment available in a lotion form. But just as important as the approval is for the company, it stands to benefit North Carolina. In recent years, Ortho launched a beachhead in the triangle to house its dermatology sales and marketing team of about 20. Approval of another dermatology product earlier this year led the company to ensure it would become more entrenched in the area as commercial demand continues expanding. Company President Bill Humphreys, former CEO of Raleigh-based MERS, North Carolina, says the most recent approval is a win for the Triangle. As an important and core segment of Bausch Health Company's Ortho Dermatologics commercial leadership teams, including many key leaders of Solta Medical in North Carolina, are headquartered in Raleigh, he says, providing our company access to the greater Triangle community and all it offers, including high-quality talent. The approval is the fourth for the company in just 14 months. Humphreys says the Triangle team will be involved in the launch of the product later next year, but that doesn't necessarily mean we'll have a heightened presence in Raleigh. He noted, while there's no plan in place to increase the local headcount directly related to the new product, the growing company continues to evaluate our team structure and will adjust as needed in order to support our business. Next, we turn to government and regulations, and we find the article, the FAA wants to start tracking drones' locations. The Federal Aviation Administration proposed sweeping regulations Thursday that would require that all but the tiniest drones incorporate technology that would enable them to be tracked at all times while flying in U.S. airspace. Remote ID technologies will enhance safety and security by allowing the FAA, law enforcement, and federal security agencies to identify drones flying in their jurisdiction, the Federal Transportation Secretary Elaine Chao said in a statement. As drone operators, manufacturers, and others involved in the rapidly expanding drone industry begin sifting through the 319-page proposal Thursday afternoon, responses varied wildly. While some applauded the FAA for finally creating a system to rapidly identify owners of rogue and potentially deadly drones, others declared this was going to drastically hinder drone efficiency and cost effectiveness. Since 2015, operators of all drones that weigh more than half a pound have been required to register their devices by submitting their names along with their email and home addresses to the FAA. Some federal facilities, prisons for example, are authorized to use systems to detect the presence of drones, said Reggie Govan, a former chief counsel to the FAA, who now teaches at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. But at the moment, officials do not have a quick way to identify the owner of a given drone or to track the location of drones that have been registered by a particular person. Even airports and power plants currently lack the legal authority to track drones, Govan said. At the simplest level, the proposed regulation requires all drones more than 0.55 pounds to emit a very particular kind of signal. Once you have drones that are emitting an identifier, then you can have a system that can track all drones, Govan said, adding that he applauded the regulations. Brendan Shulman, vice president for policy and legal affairs at DJI, a Chinese company that is one of the leading manufacturers of small consumer drones, said for the past several years, industry leaders and government stakeholders had tried to figure out how to create a sort of drone license plate system. He said that the proposed system could make sense. His primary concern is that the cost and burden to drone pilots and operators remain low, something he's still evaluating. DJI was embroiled in another government drone matter with mounting security concerns that the cameras and other technology on its drones could send surveillance data back to China. But for Paul Aitken, a founder of Drone U, a drone pilot training company in New Mexico, the costs immediately struck him as excessive. The new regulations require all registered drones within 36 months to begin carrying a specific type of remote identification system that broadcasts over the Internet. Often finding an Internet connection is not feasible in the locations where drone operators fly, Aiken said. According to his reading of the rules, if you don't have cellular service or another way to connect to the Internet, operators will have to limit flights to 400 feet laterally, which is roughly to the end of a block and back. Search and rescue missions often require going at least four times that distance, he said. People will literally die from these rules, he said, adding that other industries that are thriving with drones, like utility inspection, precision agriculture, land surveying, ranch management, and even some construction management, would suffer greatly, given that the rules undermine efficiency, which for many is part of the appeal of drones. He's also concerned that drone pilots will have to publicly disclose their locations. Pilots need privacy to protect them from fear-based citizens who think that drones are spying on them, he said. In New York City, Councilman Justin Brannon said he thought this was a step in the right direction. However, it's illegal to fly a drone in most of New York City. We need to create a framework for drones to legally and safely operate here in New York City, because I do believe the benefits outweigh the risk, he said. The notice of proposed rulemaking, as the proposed legislation is called, will be open for a 60-day comment period. At that point, the regulations become law. Jonathan Ruprecht, a Florida-based lawyer who specializes in drones, was left with many questions as to how this would be enforced. He pointed out that the FAA had rarely prosecuted violations of drone regulations, such as flying in a careless manner or flying an unregistered aircraft, over the past decade. They should refrain from biting off more than they can chew, he said. Ruprecht said that focusing on locations that need protecting, instead of creating an unwieldy tracking system for the entire United States, would be more realistic. And now another article on the healthcare front. Pardon me. The article is entitled 2020 Vision, and Biogen Industry Could See First New Alzheimer's Drug in Years. For the first time in years, not one, but two new products for Alzheimer's disease are expected to be submitted for FDA approval in 2020. The most controversial and closely watched of them is Biogen's drug aducanumab, which targets a protein called amyloid in the brain, the buildup of which has been linked to the disease. Biogen has a major manufacturing operation in RTP. Biogen originally discontinued testing on the drug in March, but revived it 6 months later after considering new data that has split the scientific community. The other product likely to be considered for FDA approval is San Diego-based Acadia Pharmaceuticals Incorporated's drug Nuplazid, which successfully treated Alzheimer's-related hallucinations and psychosis in late-stage data released in early December. Should Biogen's drug be approved, it would be the first entirely new treatment since Forest Laboratory Incorporated's treatment Namenda hit the market in 2003. That drug blocks a brain chemical that causes cell death. The only other drug to hit the market in the last 15 years was Allergan Incorporated's Namzaric. It combines two pre-existing drugs to address memory loss and cognition. Despite the treatment needs, Namenda has struggled commercially over the last couple of years amid a class action antitrust lawsuit. The dearth of applications is not for lack of trying. More than 125 potential drugs have entered the clinic over the last two decades, but few have emerged. One report found that Alzheimer's drugs have a 99.6% failure rate. Alzheimer's Association Director of Scientific Engagement, Rebecca Edelmeyer, said that landscape is changing as the industry enters the golden age of biomarker research, giving researchers the ability to better track the effects of their drugs. Just 7 years ago, we didn't have a way to look into the brain of someone living with Alzheimer's. Now we do. It's allowing us to leapfrog many of our ideas along, she said. Hopefully, within the next decade, we'll have the ability to start thinking more strategically about Alzheimer's. And with this article, there's a very small graph that ranks the three biotech pharma companies in the Raleigh-Durham-Chapel Hill area So I'll read these. Ranked number one is Pfizer with 3,610 employees in the Triangle. Second rank is Grifols with 2,183 employees in the Triangle. And third in this list, GlaxoSmithKline with 1,900 employees. Now, another article in the government and regulations arena. And this one's entitled NC Commerce Secretary's November Job Announcements and Secret Meetings. And I'll read this, but there's a lot of it's about redacted articles, so you may find it a little frustrating to listen to, and I apologize. November marked another busy month for the state's top economic developer, North Carolina Department of Commerce Secretary Tony Copeland. Public records provided by Commerce show a slew of trips and job announcements, and at least three meetings, the contents of which aren't being revealed because they involve discussions of active projects. November the 7th, for example, Copeland traveled to Tarboro for a 9 a.m. to noon meeting, but details of the meeting are completely redacted in the documents. On November the 12th, his flight out of RDU was redacted, as were attendees of a noon to 3 p.m. meeting. Commerce later clarified that Copeland was flying to New Jersey but offered no hints at the nature of the trip. He returned to RDU the same day. Another redaction happens November the 19th, when Copeland was in Chapel Hill for an undisclosed meeting at noon. Later that same day, he attended the announcement for Project Well, also known as Well.Inc., in Chapel Hill. That project involves 400 jobs and a new operations center on Franklin Street for Well.Inc., a healthcare IT firm. Other scheduled highlights for November. November 1st, Copeland speaks at the Centric Brands grand opening in Greensboro. November 5th, Copeland meets with five site selectors at the North Carolina Biotechnology Center's 35th celebration in RTP. November 15, Copeland speaks at the Akzo Nobel Expansion groundbreaking event in High Point. November 18, Copeland has lunch with the new president of the Golden Leaf Foundation, Scott Hamilton. November 20, Copeland tours the College of Engineering at North Carolina State University's Centennial Campus. November 27, Copeland attends the Q-squared Q2 announcement in Research Triangle Park. November came on the heels of a very busy October for Copeland as he traveled the state and to Washington and was met with a foreign ambassador. Copeland was named to his post in 2017 by Governor Roy Cooper, but he was no stranger to commerce, having served as an assistant commerce secretary earlier in his tenure or in his career. Now, this week's Triangle Business Journal has been anything but ordinary, but frequent listeners know there's usually an opinion article found on the last page, and there is an opinion article posted on this week's listing of the Triangle Business Journal, and that opinion column is written by Andrew Sultan, who's former chief investment officer of the state treasurer's office in North Carolina, and it's entitled A Big No-No at the North Carolina Public Pension. And once again, this is just an opinion of Andrew Sultan. North Carolina State Treasurer Dale Folwell is sole fiduciary of the state's pension plans. As a result, he has investment authority over $100 billion in assets. Unfortunately, Folwell has committed two cardinal and elementary mistakes that should be of deep concern to retirees, public servants, and taxpayers. First, he violated the long-term investment rule against market timing when he sold $8.5 billion in equities over the course of this past summer and fall. The proceeds are sitting in cash where they do not earn a meaningful return. Second, he violated the rule against making the same investment mistake twice. So back in 2017, Folwell decided to time the market by selling $7.4 billion in equities and put the proceeds in cash and bonds. The first attempt at market timing failed because equity prices have risen by more than one-third. To break even on this speculation, the Dow Jones Industrial Average would have to fall by about 10,000 points. In both cases, the state treasurer has violated his own investment guidelines, and the pension system has paid the price. His first attempt to time the stock market in 2017 has cost the pension plan about $2.2 billion in value, and his decision in 2019 to move long-term investments into cash has cost the pension another $400 million. I don't doubt the state treasurer's worries about the current state of the equity markets. By most measures, stock prices are relatively expensive, and the earnings outlook is clouded by global tensions and U.S. trade policy. So there's plenty to worry about in today's market environment, just as there were a lot to fret about 2 years ago when Folwell first departed from the pension strategic asset allocation and moved $7.4 billion out of stocks. Even if the straight treasurer were to get lucky and correctly time a decline in the stock market, it'd still have the near impossible task of figuring out when to put the pile of cash back into equities. Market timing requires two highly speculative decisions: selling stock and eventually having the courage to reinvest in the throes of a declining market. Pension investing is a long-term exercise. Assets need to grow over 20 and 30-year time horizons to meet the needs of retirees and reduce the burden on taxpayers. Investment fiduciaries must look beyond the near-term twists and turns of the stock market and avoid the temptation to engage in short-term trading because market timing is a fool's errand. The state treasurer almost always highlights the $225 million of savings he achieved by firing managers and renegotiating fees. Ironically, much of the fee reduction was simply created when the treasurer decided to time the market back in 2017. And with that, we're going to have to end today's article. Because you know that music means we've run out of time for today's episode of the Triangle Business Journal. I hope you enjoyed it. Be sure to listen next time. I'm Alton Banks, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This broadcast is readily available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Today's program is generously underwritten by Brian Lee Funeral Homes, located in Raleigh, Garner, Anger. They can be reached at 919-832-8225. So if you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. So long till next time.